This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Thank you very much for that marvelous, generous welcome. And thank you, Clark, for that very generous introduction. I don't deserve it, but I also have arthritis, and I don't deserve that either. It's such a pleasure to be back in Santa Barbara. This is my third lecture or speech or forum in the last 12 years, and I always find a warm and enlightened response, and I feel myself among kindred spirits when I come here. And especially when I come here with my wife, Judith Davidson Moyers, who has been with me and I with her for 61 years. The last 30 of which we have worked together in close quarters, as with her being my executive producer, my executive editor, the president and CEO of our independent production company, responsible for so many of those productions that Clark just mentioned. She has been there in the control room, in my ear and in my head, where you can't see it, and always in my heart, where I never stop feeling it. She is the one person in our company and our entourage who will tell me the truth even when it hurts. And that's what you want when you're on the air as a broadcast journalist. I'm glad she could be here with me. I have a special place in my heart for the CAP Center, which both Clark and Leonard Wallach run. It's been special in my heart because I met Walter Capps when he was a member of Congress. I was in Washington several times. We were at more than one occasion together. And I learned then that he was a principled representative of you and a principled representative of democracy and a principled representative of the Constitution. You could not have done better. And I have been so impressed with what Congresswoman Capps has done since she succeeded Walter in this. I was quite disturbed when I heard today, after arriving here, that she plans to retire at the end of this year and next January, but I can't hold it against her. She's only 79, and Judith and I retired our weekly series last year when I turned 81 and she turned 80, so we felt it was time, and surely Lois deserves some time to be out here with her her family and grandchildren, and I know you will welcome her back and pay tribute to her for the years of distinguished service that she rendered to democracy along with her husband, Walter. They are truly ideals of public service. I also have another special place for Lillian Lovelace, who is here. She and her late husband, John Lovelace, endowed the Martin Marty Lecture that Martin Marty gave the first of, and I'm giving the most recent of. Martin Marty, John and Lillian Lovelace, and Judith and I have been very close friends until his retirement 25 years ago. Marty was a distinguished professor at the University of Chicago of religious history and the author of many important books, including studies of fundamentalism, early Christianity, Christianity in modern America, just an immensely prolific contributor to our understanding of the role of religion in our public life and in our private affairs. People ask me often, why do you keep covering religion as a journalist when we know you have moved on in your own odyssey, your own journey? And I say, because I understand that religion is the prime, if not, is the one of the prime, if not the prime, motivator of human behavior. And any journalist, as any scholar or any politician, needs to understand the role, both the positive and the negative role, that religion plays in politics and human behavior and in the affairs of the world. Martin Marty taught me so much of what I know about religion, and he still maintains a blog. He still watches the news and comments on it critically, and I just wish he could be here tonight, but he is actually here in spirit with us and probably watching any way he can. I'm delighted to be back. It occurred to me just a few minutes ago that when I was here the last time, it was just after the week of the mass shooting in Arizona, when Congresswoman Giffords was critically injured and several were killed. And I devoted most of my comments here to that occasion, wondering why it is that a democracy which you would expect could solve the problems it creates for itself, in this case with the Second Amendment, couldn't solve those problems. And then, of course, last year you had your own mass killing nearby with the shooting of, three young people and the wounding of 14 others by a young man who left that note saying, "I'm getting my revenge on the world tonight." And again, sitting back in the green room, I wondered, why is it our democracy is so dysfunctional that it cannot solve a problem that is literally killing us? If I come back a fourth time, I hope somehow we have addressed that critical issue. Now, perhaps you saw the headline a few weeks ago, quote, "A man ripped off a Muslim woman's hijab and screamed, 'This is America.'" A man ripped off a Muslim woman's hijab and screamed, "This is America." When I read that, I thought, welcome to the 2016 election, because that's the temper with which this election is being waged. That's the environment in which our so-called national discourse is taking place, pulsing with fear, hatred, incivility, violence, violent language, violent acts in different campaigns. And that headline seemed to encapsulate for me what has happened to America as we approach this election. And I chose the title, coming in November, the rapture, apocalypse, or Armageddon, because when I interviewed Joseph Campbell in that series 25 years ago, The Power of Myth, talked about that the last time I was here too. The last thing Joe said to me when I left, after Judith and I were saying farewell and departing George Lucas's Skywalker Ranch, where we taped those interviews, the last thing Joe said to me as we walked out on the front porch was, "You intend to stay with this," meaning staying with this sort of journalism. And I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, just remember that if you want to change the world, change the metaphors." And he's right. We have to be able to see the world differently if we're going to change the world and stay the course that is leading us now to the edge. And both those terms, which come from the book of Revelation, the rapture, the apocalypse, and Armageddon, are metaphors for how people a long time ago saw the world playing out. And I tend to think of this election in those terms. In the rapture in the end times, I represented in the book of Revelation, either before or simultaneously with the coming of Christ again to earth, represented the rising up of the dead from the earth to meet in the sky the believers who were still alive, caught up in the rapture, in the clouds, to meet the Lord in the air. There are many people who think of this election that way. I don't know on whose side they think of it, but they do. The apocalypse in the book of Revelation represents the complete final destruction of the world as described in those pages, the ultimate victory of good over evil. the apocalypse. And there are many people who see this election in those metaphorical terms. Armageddon also comes from the book of Revelation and is the place where the armies of God will gather for that last battle of the end times. Literally, it means a mountain or a range of hills. It's also the name of an interesting 1998 American science fiction movie that I urge you to see. But these metaphors strike me as pertinent to the way this campaign is playing out. Already, it is revealing what the great historian of civilizations, Arnold Toynbee, called schisms in the soul of society. Schisms in the soul of society. Raising such questions as, who are we as a people? What kind of people do we want to represent us? And what future will be our legacy to the generations that follow? We're not seeing in this election the typical clash of left versus right. Not yet, at least. The 20 million votes already cast for Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders represent far more than the opposition simply to the other candidates who are running against them. They are, in effect, a populist earthquake like none other in my time. I mean, you could say that the 1968 election was seen by many people as a combination of the rapture, the apocalypse, and Armageddon. George Wallace running segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. Gene McCarthy running against Lyndon Johnson, Robert Kennedy coming in, the war in Vietnam, Richard Nixon. That all became a welter, an organ, a combustion of aspiration, malice, and mischief. But it wasn't quite the populist uprising that I see today. For this is, as I will try to explain later in the evening, a revolt of rank and file Americans against what is obviously to anyone, left, right, Democrat, Republican, independent, or non-aligned, a rotten political system wrought by two parties that have survived too long on euphemisms and false promises, and are now reaping the whirlwind of betraying the everyday people who trusted them. More on that later. For the moment, my friend and fellow journalist Hedwig Smith, formerly of the New York Times, has summed it up well. This is, he says, a revolt against the power elite in both parties. Middle America against the power brokers, small donors versus super PACs, the 99% against the 1%, agents of change versus the status quo, shared prosperity versus trickle-down economics, a neglected majority against an entrenched elite. And the challenge from both Sanders and Trump so far represents both popular antagonism to big money and big corporations, and the erosion in public faith in American democracy and capitalism. Nearly 20 years ago, my very good friend and mentor, John Gardner, a Republican, the founder of Common Cause, a wonderful organization with grassroots and energy to try to reform our political system, especially concerning the power of money in politics. John Gardner wrote me a letter in which he said, "We are treading the edge of a precipice here when people lose faith in civilization, when people no longer believe their society is just. The whole venture falls apart." That is so true. Civilization is nothing, although it's everything. It's nothing but the thin layer of civility stretched across the passions of the human heart. It can snap any time. And terrible things happen. We saw it in Europe in the 1920s. We've seen it elsewhere. During the first century BC, the Roman Republic, the price of empire destabilized the Roman Republic. And in the end, Augustus, who was the heir of the popular party, terminated the republic by fiat and installed himself as emperor. He did so by ending all the forms of the republic, keeping all the forms of the republic, while he dispensed with their meaning. He kept all the forms of the republic while dispensing with the meaning. Which brings me to Donald Trump. After 250 years, since the words on that parchment, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and the prologue to the Constitution, the most beautiful array of succinct language I think I have ever read, after we, the people, let off that Constitution, after the Emancipation Proclamation and the suffering of the wounded and dying at Petersburg and Vicksburg and Gettysburg, after the Emancipation Proclamation, after the incredible upsurge of citizens fighting for democracy as populists in the 1880s and as progressives in the 1890s and the early part of the 20th century, after FDR's Four Freedoms and Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream, after a senator who had become the accidental president from the former Confederate state of Texas claimed the words of the civil rights movement for all of us of whatever our color, white or black or brown or yellow, and said before the Congress and the nation, we shall overcome. After all of that, after the landing at Normandy and the landing on the moon, after Marian Anderson sang God Bless America on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, after all that, that created the tradition of this country at its best, after all of that, it's come down to this: a colossus of ignorance and narcissism, boasting, quote, there's nobody like me, nobody. As a once great party, the party of Lincoln, the party of emancipation, the party of Theodore Roosevelt in our national parks and Dwight David Eisenhower and sending troops to make sure the schools in Little Rock were integrated. After all of that, the grand old party falls one by one like dominoes in submission to his ego. There's nobody like me. The truth is, he's no body. There's nothing material there. He's a fleeting series of shape-shifting images that depend entirely on television for our perception of him. And while he now brags to the world, quote, I live on what is considered the best block of real estate anywhere in the world, Fifth Avenue between 56th Street and 57th Street, right next to Tiffany's, he really lives nowhere except in the minds of his followers, for whom he is a personal Rorschach test, playing back to them their own deep need for escape from the slings and arrows of life. He is the fantasy king of the Kardashian era in American history, in which we live happily after winning the lottery on reality TV. I mean, also notice he never keeps his eyes on you. You cannot look him in the eye. He's there and then he's gone. He's in his black limousine, his black SUV, on his private plane, jetting off to his private estate in Florida. If you were on a sinking ship, I'm convinced, with Donald Trump, and heard him shout, "Women and children first," it would be because he wanted to test the strength of the lifeboats. There is no thing. There is nothing there except what we read into him. In his famous book called The Image, the late historian and librarian of Congress, Daniel Boorstin, wrote, quote, "The celebrity is a person who is known for his well-knownness. His qualities or his lack of qualities illustrate our peculiar problems. He's neither good nor bad, great nor petty. He's the human pseudo-event. He has been fabricated on purpose to satisfy our exaggerated expectations of human greatness. He is made by all of us who willingly read about him on television, see him on television and read about him, who buy recordings of his voice and talk about him to our friends, but his relation to morality and even to reality is highly ambiguous." So, he comes to us by Twitter to save us. On Easter morning, he tweeted, quote, "Another radical Islamic attack, this time in Pakistan, targeting Christian women and children, at least 67 dead, 400 injured. I alone can save. I alone can save. I alone can solve. He alone has the potion. He alone is able to call out the incantation. He alone can cast the spell and remove the demons. Alone, he will save us." He is Mussolini and Berlusconi and George Wallace and Napoleon in a trucker's hat. Napoleon Bonaparte said, "I am not an ordinary man. I am an extraordinary man, and ordinary rules do not apply to me." So, he can call women bimbos, fat pigs, slobs, and dogs, and become the nominee of a major party. He can say of a lawyer that she is disgusting for requesting a break in the trial to pump breast milk and move closer to the power to name the next three justices of the Supreme Court. He can rail against immigrants of color and cause the heart of every white supremacist to race at the thought of a president as carpenter in chief building walls between America and the world. What was it Yeats said? "We have fed the heart on fantasy, and now the heart has been made brutal." Another of our friends, the writer Mark Dannon, whom you saw two or three times on our weekly show, says in this week's issue of the New York Review of Books that his very self-absorption is what his audience most admires, as they do with the Kardashians. Quote, "The narcissist's fascination with his own sweet self is the secret of this alarmingly mesmeric quality of his speeches. We're all folded up in the warm grandeur of the unmediated access to the Donald in his vision of himself. And he reaffirms it by reassuring interjections that that is precisely what they are getting." As he said recently, "By the way, no teleprompters, right? No teleprompters, no teleprompters, no reading speeches. Speak from the heart and from the head. Speak from the heart and from the head." And people actually thought that's what he was doing. In an era when we know every politician uses teleprompters, that is a gift many people take as someone speaking from the heart and from the head. He was onto something. People who no longer believed anything politicians say because they've been so often betrayed by the promises believed him because he only said what they were thinking about people they fear and hate, about a world they no longer fit, about their own sad dreams and defeats. He is the magician with the wand, the incantation, and the spell. They took him more seriously, actually, I think, than he took himself. I read this morning an excerpt from a book by one of a long article, a letter written to his followers by a man who had been a senior member of his communication staff when they began to think about a campaign. And this man is trying to warn voters that there wasn't even the thought of winning when they put this campaign together. The goal instead was for, quote, the Donald to poll in double digits and come in seconds in delegate count. That was it. The Trump camp would have been satisfied to see him polling at 22% and taking second place to the person who might hold 50%. He didn't even expect to win. His candidacy was a protest candidacy. In other words, Mark Danner writes, a celebrity making his protest run in part to bolster and increase his celebrity. For that is what celebrities do. I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV. So what does it say about us? About the several million people who have read into Trump, what they see and what they want and what they need. How did it happen? Is it that so many of our politicians have become con artists that millions of people welcome someone who admits he really is? They know, you know, I mean, they would believe him if he said, the last thing I want to do is hurt you, but it's still on my list. Or, I didn't say it was your fault, I said I was blaming you. I mean, that's appealing in a way. They know what he knows, that our system's exactly what he says it is, fake and fixed, like the card shark in Texas who says to his mark, play the cards fair, Harry, I know what I dealt you. They like Trump because he admits what we know and every other politician knows but will not say. The game is fixed. And if politics is only a casino, why not take your chance at the casino instead of in a futile exercise in the dogma of democracy that nobody really believes any longer, or the rituals of voting which never produce what we're told they will? So why not a nobody who doesn't pretend any longer the system works except to his benefit? Why not take their chances at the casino instead of in the fake ritual itself, the polling booth? Trump's triumph is terrifying, frankly, because it resists explanation. So how do we explain this success? And as of tonight, he is 77 votes away from what he needs to get the nomination. In addition to what I just said about his ability as a celebrity to fill in our wants and needs and our hopes and expectations, irrespective of whether he embraces them, the state of the Republican Party is one cause for his success. Republican leadership, the elites, the incumbents, the donors, embrace every crazy idea offered up from right-wing fabulists on Fox News and talk radio over the many years. Donald Trump isn't saying anything that the leaders of the Republican Party didn't nod to when they were trying to hold their base in the Tea Party and on Rush Limbaugh's show. They made a religion out of ignorance. The less you know, they said, about history, science, literature, ideas, black people, the more you were idealized. The public thinker Paul Berman, a man I much admire, writes that The public reminds us that John McCain in 2008 understood that Sarah Palin was unfit for high office. She couldn't even tell Katie Couric what magazines she read because everyone knew she doesn't read magazines. She was, as Paul says, a proud barbarian, confident in her illiteracy. But McCain, the nominee of the party, understood that to have any chance to win, he needed to motivate his party base, which thrived on illiteracy. So he gambled on barbarism's appeal. It was unprincipled of him. It was scandalous of him. But it was, in his mind, a matter of political survival. So that McCain, says Berman, paved the way for Trump with Palin. Both know-nothing outsiders. So that Trump is a figure without precedent in the Republican Party. He would be the first president never to have served in any political, government, or military office. And yet, Judith called out to me this morning and said, look, there is Donald Trump going to call on Henry Kissinger at the former Secretary of State's townhouse in New York. Even Kissinger didn't have what it takes to say, I'll have nothing to do with that man. He should not be within miles of American foreign policy. And yet, he too bowed in submission to the narcissist ignoramus who is going to head his party. Which leads to a second reason for his success. The first was the Republican failure of elites to uphold standards. Second is the collapse of political journalism. Berman writes about the disappearance of one newspaper after another. I think we've lost something like 20 to 25,000 reporters in the last 5 or 7 years. And the fact that news depends on fewer and fewer reporters and more on pundits who offer opinions, not facts. George Bernard Shaw once warned against journalists who are unable to distinguish between a bicycle accident and the collapse of civilization. Well, I remember Shaw's statement every time I see most pundits on television. There are no facts, only opinions. The surviving newspapers and political magazines, of which there are still some good ones, understaffed and underfunded, have lost their professional edge. They rarely have the resources or the desire anymore to hold power accountable. Libel suits are expensive, as Judith and I can testify. These journalists, these institutions, these organizations have been disemboweled by the internet. And the effect is to leave huge portions of our population rudderless as they make political decisions deprived of solid political reporting. This part of our population, and it includes many of us, I'm afraid, are addicted to the cyber hysterias of their electronic devices, deprived of leadership by institutional systems, deprived of a sense of history and of our political tradition, incapable of judging any longer the quality of leadership. Everybody, all of these pundits kept saying that once Trump gets the nomination, he will begin to appear presidential. These people have no idea what it means to be presidential. So Trump can set a new standard, as he will in fact do. James Baldwin wrote that you can judge the state of society's educational level by the quality of its political speeches. By that standard, it feels like an understatement to say our national intelligence has never been more degraded. And yet, we need to be smarter and wiser than ever. We are on the cusp, and I just mentioned one of these issues. We're on the cusp of a ruined planet. Climate change is bearing down on us. We're losing biodiversity, forests, fisheries, and soils. Toxins accumulate in our ecosystem and in our bodies. This crisis calls for a deep restructuring of our way of life and our economy based on an affirmation of life and the devoted care that life requires of us. But instead, masses are persuaded that only a strong man can save us. Not knowledge, not information, just a strong leader. That's yet another reason for Trump's success, the denial of facts. Also, we have been through four turbulent decades in which the rich and powerful have been hell-bent on making the world work for them at the expense of everybody else. So that instead of producing a better life for everyone, capitalism now procreates vast wealth at the top and wage stagnation at the bottom. Those are the two extremes in our country that are growing. Meanwhile, the middle class, the usual bulk of democracy, the usual bulwark of democracy, the usual people from whom our most active political citizenship comes, the middle class continues to shrink. But contrary to the argument that the right and elite economists have pushed, this death of the middle class is not the result of inevitable natural forces. It is the result of political decisions. We're seeing the fruits of deliberate action at the highest levels of power to shrink the middle class. This morning, I was going through a new study from the Pew Research Center. Pew Research Center is a nonpartisan, important, credible, highly respected research center based in Philadelphia. And their new study shows that the size of the I'm going to be throwing some statistics at you, but I hope as I do that you remember the wise person who said that it is the mark of a truly educated person to be deeply moved by statistics. Now, so I hope you're going to be deeply moved by these statistics. The study shows that the size of the middle class fell in virtually all parts of our country between 2000 and 2014. 9 out of 10 metropolitan areas showed a decline in middle class households. The median income for middle class households fell by almost 5% in those years. Their median wealth, that is assets minus debt, declined by 28% after the housing market crisis and the Great Recession that followed that crash. The middle class simply isn't what it used to be. And of course, I'm not even talking here yet about the 47 million Americans who live in poverty. Over the last 40 years, middle wage hourly wages only rose 6%, while low wage workers' wages fell by 5%. At the very same time, the very high wage earners saw a 41% increase in income. And in fact, figures like that substantially understate the long-term decline in disposable income and the quality of life experienced by what we used to call middle-class Americans. In fact, families today can be in the middle in terms of income and yet still not make enough to live on. I remember when our 16-year-old son came in and asked for an increase in his allowance, and I said to him, "Don't you know, Cope, that it costs money in this world? What do you need the money for?" And he said, "Well, Dad, it costs money to date." And that's what he wanted it for. But in fact today, families can be in the middle in the terms of income and not have enough to live on. There's an organization in Washington, very credible too, the Economic Policy Initiative, that calculates it takes between $49,141 and $106,000 to maintain a family of four, depending on where you live in the country. costs for that family have risen dramatically for such, those families have risen dramatically for such big dollar items that affect middle class families. College tuition, out of policy costs under employment, health care plans, retirement. Retirement security has evaporated as corporate pension plans offer less in benefits. I was at the commencement at Rutgers College, Rutgers University in New Jersey last year. It's a state university in New Jersey, the goes back to colonial days as a land-grant college. And the president of that university said to me that 20 years ago, the state legislature contributed, taxpayers of New Jersey, contributed 80% of the cost of the State University of New Jersey. Today, it's 20%. I had an interesting conversation with your provost here at dinner tonight about what's happened here in California. So, and I asked him, where do you get the deficit? And, of course, tuitions. That's where we get it. The cost for those families living on middle income or less salaries who want to send their children to school, to college, right on through university, have increased considerably. Furthermore, household income figures have moved from one income to two income families, and two income families have higher expenses for items like clothing, transportation, and childcare. In other words, many families are middle class, but they can't make enough to get by. And get this, Americans work more hours today than citizens of any country in Western Europe. Go see Michael Moore's new film, Where to Invade Next, and you will see our colossal failure in terms of our social contract compared to those much smaller and less wealthy European countries. Here's what's happened. Our total national wealth has continued to grow even as income stagnated for most Americans. Where did all that money go? It went to the wealthiest. The top 1% of Americans captured more than half of the total income growth from 1993 to 2014. Moreover, the top 100th of 1%, some 16,500 families, were capturing more of the country's income than they had since the run-up to the Great Crash of 1929 and the Great Depression that followed. The top 0.1%, just 160,000 families in this country, owns as much wealth as 90% of all Americans. That's about 145 million families. Just 536 people had a shared net worth of $2.6 trillion at the end of 2053. And 53 families have contributed 80% of the money that has been flowing into this election year. As wages fell, corporate profits have grown at a healthy clip, much of it used to pay high executive salaries. When I was a young man, Fortune 500 CEOs earned 42 times as much on average as the typical worker. Today, they earn 373 times as much. What's happened? Now, this is a page from The Economist, the famous, highly respected, and most credible publication in the world about business affairs and capitalism. And its headline is The Problems with Profits. And the problem with profits is that the campaigns have found, I'll read you this. America used to be the land of opportunity, just a part of it. America used to be the land of opportunity and optimism. Now opportunity is seen as the preserve of the elite. Two-thirds of Americans believe the economy is rigged in favor of vested interest, and optimism has turned to anger. Voters' fury fuels the insurgencies of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders and weakens insiders. The campaigns have found plenty of things to blame, from free trade deals to the recklessness of Wall Street. But one problem with American capitalism has been overlooked. The naughty secret of American firms is that life at home is much easier. Their returns on equity are 40% higher in the United States today than they are abroad. Aggregate domestic profits are at near record levels relative to GDP. America is meant to be a temple of free enterprise. It isn't. They're not spending those huge profits on investment in the company or the future or their employees. They're saving it. They're not sharing it even with their stockholders. They're saving it. They're spending it on themselves. Last week, as I mentioned, I was at the Rutgers commencement. That's where President Obama spoke. I spoke after him, but he dominated the news, of course. He made a terrific speech. I was very proud of him, very proud that we had a president at this moment who was so intelligent and could communicate so clearly and forcefully. He had those thousands of students in his hand. But I cringed and gritted my teeth when he said to the crowd of 50,000 people and more, contrary to what we hear sometimes from both the left and the right, the system isn't as rigged as you think. The system isn't as rigged as you think. And I thought, an atypical Southern Baptist thought. I mean, even good presidents can deal in, because the system is rigged. People at the top have said to everyone else, now play the game fair. We know what we dealt you. Who rigs it? CEOs who bend the rules, Wall Street bankers who break the rules, our political class who write the rules in Congress, state legislatures, and the executive and judicial branches of government. That's how the tax breaks for the rich and powerful happen. That's who make the terrible trade deals. That's who cut the budgets of the State University of California and the State University of New Jersey and Texas and every state university in America. That's who neglects our infrastructure. That's who makes it harder for workers to collectively bargain on their own behalf. It's the people who have the power to write the rules who do so. That's why Justice Louis Brandeis, one of our great justices, the late Louis Brandeis, who said, you can have wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, or democracy, but you can't have both. 2 years ago, there was one of the most important studies in years by two of our best political scientists, armed with a small army of researchers, who studied 1,900 pieces of legislation, bills, acts of Congress, that were approved by the Senate and the House. They showed, as solidly as any political science research can, how the wealthy, the well-connected, and the politically powerful get what they want from government, the political outcomes that serve their own interest, while for the rest of us, and I'm quoting, the preferences of the average American appears to have only a minuscule, near zero, statistically non-significant impact on public policy. One headline on that study, it didn't get the attention it needed because the mainstream press, the corporate press, ignored it. One headline, U.S. no longer an actual democracy. Asking who really rules, researchers Martin Gillens and Benjamin Page argue that over the past few decades, America's political system has slowly transformed from a democracy into an oligarchy where wealthy elites wield most of the power. The highly read, popular, respected online magazine Vox, this headline, politicians listen to rich people, not you. This study is irrefutable in my estimation, convincing me, among other evidence, that we're in a doom loop of oligarchy, super PACs, dark money, jumbo joint financing committees have produced a winner-take-all politics that make the rich richer at the expense of everyone else. And the result is that inequality in America is at the greatest ever. And yet it's not the way the world works. There are not the natural forces of globalization and technology that are the prime movers of this inequality. It's the way the world is made to work. Again, headlines. Deepening inequality driving U.S. middle class into oblivion. As millions of workers face pension cuts, thanks to Wall Street greed, executive benefits remain lavish. Huffington Post. The House just voted to give Wall Street billions from Americans' retirement savings. Dark money group spends thousands attacking Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which was trying to write new rules and regulations to protect you, the citizens. And this one, which I think sums it up, free speech, big money, bad elections. One more, million-dollar donors pump huge sums into 2016 White House race. More than 50 individuals and entities have shelled out at least $1 million to big money groups backing presidential candidates, with close to half of the big donors giving to one super PAC. And then the most shattering, the most unacceptable result of inequality, this headline: report reveals rising poverty for children in America. There are roughly 3 million more U.S. children living in poverty today than during the outbreak of the Great Recession in 2008. And the so-called economic recovery has bypassed children of color altogether, a harrowing new report reveals. And that report was not prepared by the Bernie Sanders campaign. It came again from one of the most respectable foundations in America that has spent years — we worked with them previously when Judith and I did several series about children — comes from the Baltimore-based Annie E. Casey Foundation, which took a hard look and confirmed that the number of poor children in this country is increasing. Last week, I watched John Stewart being interviewed by David Axelrod at the University of Chicago Institute of Politics. Axelrod was Barack Obama's campaign manager in 2008, a brilliant student of American politics, and the management of Obama's campaign in 2008 was the most brilliantly managed campaign I've seen in my years in politics, government, and journalism. I consider Stewart one of our greatest journalist humorists. I mean, if I had his sense of humor, I might have survived another 40 years in this business. But he's the greatest journalist humorist since Mark Twain. And when John Stewart came on our show the first time, I said to him, you know, if Mark Twain were here today, he'd be the host of The Daily Show. And John's answer was, but I would never be able to write the book he wrote, which John knew was called The Gilded Age, because Mark Twain gave the Gilded Age its name in a novel that he wrote at the time. And he named the problem. There was a great Greek philosopher who said, if you want to understand a problem, you must first name it. And Mark Twain named what was happening in the post-industrial revolution as the Gilded Age. And last week, John Stewart told his audience that however he painted the American political system when he was hosting The Daily Show, it's so much worse than you could ever imagine. It's a cesspool, he said. It's a rotting system, he called it. And he urged young people who want to change it, get into it and don't get it on you. Be sure to wear a hazmat suit. You know, we have some work to do. That's the real point of my talk tonight. Reinhold Niebuhr, that great thinker of the 20th century who was to ethics and politics what Martin Marty was to history and religion, Reinhold Niebuhr said that the temper and integrity which the political fight is waged is more important for the health of our society than any particular policy. But our campaigns now are designed to distract us from what really matters, and that's the main source of Trump's success. They treat our elections as reality TV shows. Our giant media conglomerates make no effort to distinguish between news and entertainment. They play a game of wink, wink. They collude in trivializing democracy as a game of insiders while the rest of us are left to look on from the outside. In the Los Angeles Times this morning, the critic Mary McNamara points out that Fox News's Megyn Kelly didn't ask Donald Trump to be on her special yesterday so she could get back at him for calling her a bimbo or so she could pin him down on policy issues. No, she invited him to co-star in an hour-long infomercial for her new book. That's the way the media works. And the president of CBS, where I spent some years in my early career, the president of CBS, has three times told trade associations of broadcasters, Donald Trump has been a gold mine for us. Donald Trump, every time he's on, brings in viewers, and that brings in ratings, and that brings in dollars from advertisers. Bring him on, he said. And that's why the networks have broken all precedent and allowed Donald Trump to call in for his interviews instead of being present for a television interview. They want his money, even if the price of his money is President Donald Trump. So it is that we are assaulted today by what the late scholar Clint Brooks called the bastard muses. Propaganda, which pleads unscrupulously for a special case at the expense of the total truth. Propaganda. Sentimentality, which works up emotional purposes unwarranted by and in excess of the occasion. Sentimentality. And pornography, which focuses on one powerful drive at the expense of the total human personality. So it is that our democracy today is poisoned by so many lies that truth is now stranger than fiction, just not as popular. So as Yeats said, we have fed the heart on fantasies, and the heart's grown brutal from the fair. I'll stop there. We'll deal a little later in the question and answer period with what are some possible solutions. I don't like to leave people in despair because I don't like to leave myself in despair. And I do think let me just say, let me just leave you with this thought. Blind faith in bad leadership is not patriotism. See you in a few minutes.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.